Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello, and welcome to ID the Future. Why is the origin of life so important when it comes to the debate between the new atheists and those who see evidence for intelligent design? In this second part of a series of podcasts, Discovery Institute fellow Paul Nelson interviews Rabbi Moshe Averick on the clues he gleaned from the new atheists themselves.
In part two of the book, that's chapters 3, 4, and 5, you address the question of the origin of life. Why do you think that question in particular is so important to this debate that we're talking about, this atheism-theism debate?
Well, look, I've taught classes for many years about the issue of belief in God. And at one point, I would always talk about evolution. And at one point, I realized two things. Number one, I realized no matter what I said, I had to explain to them what evolution was. And then I had to show them why it didn't make sense. A lot of them don't even care. It's like they don't know about it. They don't care about it. But I realized no matter what I said, I'm not a scientist, and I never claimed to be a scientist. I don't have the credentials. So people are sitting there, maybe what he's saying is right. How do I believe? How come that there's a guy like Jerry Coyne who was, as a scientist, I don't question his credentials at all. As a philosopher, he's in outer space, or metaphysicist, but a scientist. So why would they believe me as opposed to him? Okay, that's number one. Number two, I realized no matter what I would say, they're churning out so much material all the time. I don't have time to keep up with every single new development. So I felt that I would just give a rough outline and say, look, you've got to look into it yourself. That's what I would do. When I started reading The Blind Watchmaker, when I got back to the States, I was looking through it to try to see, is there, you know, this is a pretty recent book, is there some, can I find like the simplest things to focus in on what the problems are? And it was the God delusion, excuse me. And yeah. I come across the God delusion, and I see Richard Dawkins writes, he starts talking about origin of life, and he says, this is a flourishing but speculative field. And as soon as that speculative, and like a bell went off. And you know, I saw that interview with Stephen Meyer. And he said, how did he get on his whole thing about, you know, signature in the cell? He said the same thing. He said he thought they had this whole thing sewn up. I remember from high school, the Stanley Miller experiment. I thought it was all one big thing, evolution, origin of life. And it hit me. This is the first time I realized they are conceptually two totally different issues. And whereas a guy like Richard Dawkins will claim that, you know, he could talk to you all day long about evolution, origin of life? Well, it's speculative. I don't know. I'm waiting for the chemist to give us a word. Nobody really knows. And I realize this is the area that people can easily understand. This is the area to focus in on for me, for someone like myself, a lay person, and to talk to other lay people.
So when you dove into the literature, what did you find? What struck you the most?
What struck me the most is as soon as I knew what to Google, the same thing. Well, it's a great mystery, but we're looking into it. It's a tremendous mystery, but we're still looking into it. We don't know. We have no clue. Some guys are much more candid. We don't have any clue. And then I came across, you know, Robert Shapiro, who says these theories are absolutely ridiculous. And you know, it's like a golf ball playing its way around a golf course by itself. That's how likely the whole RNA molecule theory is. And other people, you know, with the same time. And then one of my favorites that I find you have Robert Shapiro talking about it. He said how ridiculous the RNA theory is. And then you have Leslie Orgel writing back an article who says, Dr. Shapiro, you know, your theory, you know, he presents the metabolism first theory. Yeah. He says, you know, a theory has to stand on its own merits. You can't just say because my theory doesn't work so well. And he says, and your theory is based on, and this is in the article, if pigs could fly chemistry, you know, and, you know, this is getting like a little testy here, you know. And I found there was one after the other. This guy calls that theory ridiculous. No, your theory is ridiculous. And the truth is, I've come to the conclusion, Paul, because of my deep, deep respect for scientists, I agree with all of them.
So let me put it to you this way. You have a lot of common sense, horse sense, let's say, and these kinds of statements, let's take them out of science, let's put them in some other part of human life.
Right.
Where you have mutually canceling assertions.
Right.
Professions of ignorance.
Right.
We haven't solved the problem, but we will. Give us another 50 years and so forth. Right. That triggers certain intuitions. What did that trigger for you at a deeper level?
It triggered the intuition that this is how people talk when they are desperately guarding a leap of faith and they don't want to be challenged. This is how people talk with them. I mean, and I know, and look, I know myself, I've been in a position where, you know, I've taken a position on something and I realize I'm wrong. Until I get to the point where I'm ready to say, okay, I'm wrong, I know that I'm capable of coming up with ridiculous arguments to back myself up. And I realize this is what they're doing. They are, and I think that's the part of the reason why there is what I've seen on these, some of the atheist sites when I present these ideas, and I present them very dispassionately. The reaction is so, it is vicious, and it's so angry and visceral. And these are people who don't want to be poked. You're poking them in a very uncomfortable place.
Yeah. So in other words, it's like there's kind of, not to get too clinical here, but there are certain sort of psychological symptoms.
There's a cognitive dissonance. There is a need not to believe in God. That's what I see. I mean, at the bottom line, and I'm saying this as a rabbi,
yeah.
I've dealt with people who are on the, you know, who have gone through the steps to becoming more involved in religion and stuff. And it's not easy. It's not an easy process. And I never push people.
Yeah.
And people have blocks, have psychological and emotional blocks to dealing with to the reality of God if they've never really dealt with it before. And I think that's what you're seeing here.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical. Origin of life research is going to continue. And in fact, I think origin of life researchers, because they're trying to solve such a difficult problem, end up learning a lot.
Right.
Let me give you a parallel. Prior to the development of atomic theory,
right.
Understanding of what an element is,
right.
Gold, lead, so forth, there was a real industry, I guess you could say, of trying to turn base metal into gold.
Right.
I mean, after all, they're both ductile. They're both, you know, lead's ductile. It's heavy and massive and so forth. Gold is as well. We find them as ores. There are a lot of similarities there that would lead one to believe, if I can just get the right recipe, I can turn this lead into this gold.
Right.
Now, we know that that cannot be done unless one has a particle accelerator. You know, you've got to change the atomic structure of these elements in a fundamental way to achieve that transformation. So we go back and we say to the alchemists or whoever's trying to do this, you're wasting your time. You're putting a question to nature that cannot be answered in the terms that you prefer. Stop wasting your time. Don't do this. And they say, well, look, we've got a problem here. We're trying to solve it. So let's take that.
Uh-huh. I hear what you're
saying. And come to this question of the origin of life. If research is going to go forward, be funded by our National Science Foundation,
right. Let's
say, and you are in the position of an advisor standing on the sidelines saying you guys are going about this wrong, you've got a metaphysical commitment that's driving your research, and they say, well, we're going to keep doing it anyway. Give them a healthy approach to the question that they're asking that won't lead to, I'm going to keep working on it no matter what. You're in the position, let's say, to advise Robert Shapiro,
right?
Or he's dead now, but Leslie Orgel, or Gerald Joyce, or some other person working on the origin of life. You know, you're out at a bar, it's late at night, you're being very candid one-on-one with this person. What would you say to them? Having read as much as you have.
Right. I don't have a lot of, you know, in terms of, again, in terms of the science, you know, there's no question. I have an awe of scientists, and for whatever the reason is, I've tried to study science. For some reason, it's like hitting a wall. I don't have much to tell them as a scientist, but I would have something to tell them in terms of, you know, why would you think that that you're going to discover less if you are looking into the creation of a transcendent supernatural creator? Why do you think that would somehow stop you from exploring it? I don't understand the attitude. In fact, it would drive you even more. I mean, and even, you know, practically speaking, you certainly know more than me. You know some very deeply religious scientists. It doesn't get in the way of their scientific research at all. I certainly know a number in New York of, you know, research biologists, physicists who are very deeply orthodox. It doesn't do anything. It makes them more fascinated. And it certainly doesn't make them less fascinated. So that's what I don't understand. And that's I don't know what else I could say besides that.
Well, maybe that's all that needs to be said, is that coming at reality from a theistic foundation does not stand in the way of scientific discovery. In fact, if you look at the history of science prior to Darwin, most of it was done in that.
Right, Right.
And a great deal was learned.
Right.
A great deal was learned. In fact, Darwin himself, as a young man at Cambridge, had to learn his Paley, and it provided the foundation for his future work as a biologist.
Well, you know, I'm going to add one thing on what you just said. Somehow there has been this bizarre idea put out that we're talking about, that if you believe in God, that somehow is anti-science. And I think I mentioned it yesterday, we were chatting. I got one post that says, my position is morally offensive because I am, if I don't, you know, if what I believe means I'm anti-medical research. Now, where does a guy get a ridiculous idea like that? I don't know. He said it. And he was like, the tone of it was like crying, like, no, it's morally offensive. You're anti-medical research. People would die because of it. I thought, is this for real? Is the guy, you know, having a nervous breakdown or something? But he wrote it. Yeah. Any case.
Oh, dear. The things that pop up on the on the web.
Yeah.
That was Discovery Institute fellow Paul Nelson interviewing Rabbi Moshe Averick, author of Nonsense of a High Order, The Confused and Illusory World of the Atheist. Stay tuned for part 3. For ID the Future, I'm Annika Smith with the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.